Thanks for tuning in for the September 29th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's What's Trending feature highlights a profile on prion disease. In the other segment, you'll hear a discussion on visual processing changes in patients with visual snow syndrome.
Hey, it's Jason Crowell. Just a quick word before we start the interview this week. I sat down with Sonia Vallab from the Broad Institute in Cambridge to talk about her work researching therapy for prion diseases. In part one this week, you will hear Sonia talk about her mother's story, her own story, and how she became a prion scientist. And we'll talk a little bit about the research that she has ongoing into therapies. Next week, we will talk about her decision to undergo genetic testing, as well as whether other neurodegenerative diseases may also be prion diseases. Thanks for listening. Hey, it's Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. I'm on the phone today with Sonia Vallab. She is a prion scientist at the Broad Institute in Cambridge. And today we're talking about prions. So Sonia, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about prion research and all the work that you're doing.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for our listeners, you may have read or heard about Sonia and her husband, Eric Minickel, and her mother, Kamini Vallab. There have been several stories written about them in The New Yorker, The New York Times, NPR. Sonia, I first heard about your story in the Wired article that was published back on January 15th, 2019, written by Kelly Clancy. That article was titled, One Couple's Tireless Crusade to Stop a Genetic Killer. And the story of you and your family is an incredible one. And before we talk about prion research, I think it would be important for us to spend just a few minutes talking about how you and your husband got to where you are. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to begin with maybe just the story of your mother's disease and how you first learned about prions.
Sure. Yes, it was a totally unexpected path. My husband, Eric, and I got married in 2009. And then not long after that, we went through this major unexpected family event together, which is that my mom started getting sick. And it came at us completely out of the blue, super rapidly. I remember hearing that she had some unexpected weight loss. She was having some unexplained blurry vision. These things did not seem like big problems, but you fast forward 1, 2, 3 weeks, and she's too confused to carry on a conversation. She's mumbling, trailing off, forgetting things. Her ability to communicate was just falling apart. And she continued to lose muscle. She continued to sort of lose her ability to do basic things, even walk independently, take a bath, feed herself. Eventually, she couldn't be unsupervised because she just forgot. She would just forget that she had lost so much muscle that she couldn't stand without help. And so you left her alone for a second, she would stand, she would fall, and she would hit her head. And then she was too confused to tell you if she was still in pain from that, if, you know, the impact had just like sort of passed or if it was a big problem. So there was sort of scan after scan, just trying to chase these like secondary events that were flowing from this unknown cause. All we could see is that whatever it was moving super fast. So, I mean, it was February, March when we were seeing these first chapters. By June, she was effectively on life support. And we'd been chasing around a diagnosis for all those months, including sort of traveling her around. She came here to Boston. And through that, we had no diagnosis. And as summer sort of moved into fall, she was basically no longer aware of us. And by December, we got sort of this preliminary diagnosis of maybe this is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. She had a living will that said, I don't want to be kept alive with a terminal diagnosis. Finally, here was this potential diagnosis of an incurable disease, and we reached a family consensus to take her off life support. So that was just like a year of total crisis with no answers. And then several months after her death, her autopsy results made their way back to me, and here were some of the answers, but they were a total unwelcome surprise. What we learned was that she had died of genetic prion disease, and that term genetic was basically the first it had occurred to me that this wasn't over, that I was at risk, and there was a 50-50 chance that this single point mutation that had caused her disease, I had inherited. So this was sort of a crossroads for Eric and I, making the decision of whether to get predictive genetic testing. Many people who, you know, really wanted the best for us and were trying to protect us encouraged us not to get testing. because at that time, prion disease was universally fatal, untreatable, nothing you can do to prevent it. I think it was tempting for people to advise us, there is just nothing you can do. And I didn't exactly have an answer to that. I didn't know exactly what it was we would do with this information once we had it. But I think it was just a personality type decision. We really felt like we needed to know the information one way or the other. So I got the test. And at the end of 2011, I learned that I did inherit this mutation from my mom. So that was really a blow. I mean, it's obviously not the result anybody hopes for. On the other hand, in retrospect, what is kind of striking to me is that learning that I was at risk was the huge catastrophe. Getting that result, it was an awful result to be handed, but it also sort of enabled us to start assimilating to this new piece of information and figuring out, what does life look like now? What are we going to do with this? We really didn't go into that moment in our lives with scientific background. I was trained as a lawyer. Eric was trained as a transportation engineer. But what we found afterwards was that we felt super motivated by what we had watched my mom go through. She, you know, died undiagnosed. And that to us said, this is a sufficiently rare disease that maybe we can't count on anybody to tell us if there's progress. Right now, it's not treatable, but who knows what could happen. And it looks like we have to be able to follow that ourselves. So we initially set out just to sort of educate ourselves on prion science on the side, enough to be able to follow whatever science might unfold over the next few years. As we did that, we got more and more engrossed in the question of whether we could play an active role in what that science was going to look like. And a few months after I got that result, I actually left my job and took like an entry-level job at Mass General Hospital in a neurogenetics lab. And Eric transitioned over from the sort of data analytics of transportation to data analytics in the bioinformatics sphere. And from there, we sort of learned some skills, worked for 2 years, and realized that like our resolve was hardening, that we wanted to find a way for our day jobs to focus on this problem that we had been dealt out of nowhere. So we sort of brainstormed, how can we shift towards focusing on prion disease all day, every day? Ended up joining a PhD program at Harvard Medical School, and through amazing good fortune, found a team of advisors at the Broad Institute, including Stuart Schreiber and Eric Lander and others, who really sort of bet on us to tackle this problem, even in our trainee years, and supported us to get started. So we've been there since 2014, defended our PhDs in 2019, and really have had the tremendous privilege of just working on this problem every day.
That's just incredible. Of course, so sad, the story about your mother, but really an inspiration to see how you've taken this information you've been given and tried to attack this problem and kind of made it your life's work. Sonia, I told you before we did this podcast that back in 2019, we had Stanley Prusiner on the podcast, of course, the Nobel Prize winner for discovering prions. And he talked about how he made that discovery. It was a really fun interview. He also told the story of how he came up with the word prion. But obviously, prion diseases like the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, so Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, fatal familial insomnia, KURU, they're quite rare. I can probably count on one hand the number of patients I've taken care of with prion diseases, and most of those were during my residency. In just a minute, I want to ask you about your research on treatments for prion diseases. So with that in mind, are there any important basics about how prions work that we should understand before we talk about potential therapeutic targets for these diseases?
Sure. First off, I just have to like reflect on how lucky we are that Dr. Prusiner did all of that work and fought that huge fight before we ever came along. And gosh, did we inherit just this treasure trove of biology and this understanding of what makes this disease tick. So I think that's one way in which we've been really lucky. But I think the other way we've been lucky is just what the answer turned out to be. As you mentioned, there's these different subtypes of prion disease that sort of go by these different historical names. There's Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, there's fatal familial insomnia. That is the clinical name attached to the mutation that I have. And there are others. And they can present slightly differently. They can have slightly different neuropathological hallmarks. It took a while for the dots to get connected between these. It really took Dr. Prusiner's discovery unifying all of these quote-unquote different subtypes. There's really just one gene and one protein. So it's literally called the prion protein gene on chromosome 20. And it produces this, you know, single RNA that produces this single protein that in its normal form is called the prion protein. We all have it. We have it in basically every tissue, and it's not normally a problem. It hangs out on the outside of cells. It doesn't seem to have a super essential role, but there it is. Normally doesn't cause disease, but it has this unusual biological ability to misfold and template the misfolding of other prion protein or PRP molecules. So you've got sort of the bad agent, the so-called prion, grabbing onto normal PRP, misfolding it in this cascade of misfolding that spreads across the brain. And this process, something about the presence of prions, then kills neurons and leads to sort of the devastation that we see on a tissue level and an organism level. The end stage is dramatic. You're talking about a process that spreads across the brain and can affect basically every domain and destroy every domain of the brain. What I think is our incredible stroke of good luck is that at the root of that whole catastrophic process, in every case of prion disease, you have the single protein. So we have this like really nicely genetically identified causal protein / drug target.
Terrific. Let's jump in now to the research that you and your husband specifically are doing in prion diseases. And I know that you're specifically looking at treatments for prion diseases and potential therapies. Can you talk a little bit about your research?
Sure. So we came into this very open-minded to what could possibly be the right approach to treating prion disease. You know, various groups had done work at various stages of the disease process. I think the misfolded prion itself is such a biological novelty that it had attracted a lot of attention. But what drew our eyes is sort of this compelling proof of concept that it's been known for decades that if you can engineer a transgenic mouse that doesn't express prion protein, and then you do the sort of traditional bioassay that we use to study prions in an animal, you just inject prions straight into the brain, and a normal mouse will go on to develop prion disease a few months later. But if you do that in a quote-unquote knockout mouse that doesn't have any prion protein itself, then there's kind of no fuel to the fire. The prions can't grab onto anything to sort of replicate themselves, and you don't get disease. It seems that dialing prion protein down to zero confers complete protection. And in the meantime, if you can dial it down to 50%, you achieve substantial protection. Those mice live more than twice as long. So there's kind of dose response that had existed in the literature. And we found ourselves looking at that and saying, it's very compelling, but it's, you know, it's from engineering these animals. How can we achieve that pharmacologically? What is the realistic way to do that with a drug? And I think this is another piece of serendipity. We were sort of coming along and coming to this question at the moment when antisense oligonucleotides were really being explored for brain disease in a serious way. The specifics of how to dose these drugs to get them into the brain, achieve a pretty wide distribution, and really impact one target protein were all being worked out. So our search led us to this technology and to a conversation with folks at Ionis Pharmaceuticals about whether antisense could be, you know, the first realistic therapeutic modality for mimicking this amazing genetic finding that had been around in the prion field for all these years. The details of the science are beautiful and complex, but the idea is super simple. You just take this antisense oligonucleotide, which is basically just, you know, chemically modified DNA, and you program the bases so that they are the reverse complement of an RNA that you want to target. The ASO goes into your cell, actually, in many cases, into the nucleus, hybridizes with that RNA, and an enzyme called RNase H will cleave the duplex, and you just take the amount of that RNA and you dial it down. Less RNA, less protein. This was our idea that we landed on in collaboration with a lot of really brilliant folks at Broad and Ionis and elsewhere for how to just reduce the amount of that prion protein in the first place.
So I have to ask, where do you stand in terms of studying that potential therapy using ASOs for prion disease?
So our first conversation with Ionis was in 2014. And what flowed out of that was a long homework list to prove that the technology and the disease were a match. We did a first round of animal studies in collaboration with Dr. Byron Coey and his group out at NIH. We learned how to do animal studies ourselves at Broad and paired with the amazing comparative medicine team there. At this point, we've done all of the prion mouse studies that we needed to do to convince ourselves that it was working, which is to say, in addition to just injecting a mouse with the drug, infecting with prions, and seeing, does it live longer than its untreated counterpart? We've tested ASOs against different prion strains in mice. We've tried different doses to see if we can sort of recreate that dose response effect, and we found that we can, even reducing the amount of prion protein in the brain transiently by about 20% led to a survival benefit. We have treated at different time points relative to prion infection, so everything from prophylactic to while prions are silently accumulating to after frank symptom onset. It varies the good that we can do across this sort of spectrum of time points. Treating early gives us the most profound beneficial effect, but even treating at a time when you can see things going wrong in the brain and potentially even see things going wrong in the animal's behavior, we've been able to see some therapeutic benefit. So I think we set a very high bar for ourselves to be convinced that this was what we wanted to bet on. And at this point, I think we and our collaborators at Ionis believe that this is working and that, you know, we want to work together to move it forward into the clinic.
Thanks for listening to part one of my interview with Sonia Val. Next week in part two, we will discuss her decision to undergo testing and also what it's like to be both a patient and a researcher. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Tisha Manteith from the University of Miami with today's neurology podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Joanne Fielding. She recently published a wonderful paper in neurology called Ocular Motor Measures of Visual Processing Changes with Visual Snow Syndrome. Joanne Fielding is an associate professor in the Department of Neuroscience at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. How are you doing, Joanne?
Oh, really well, thank you. And thanks so much for this opportunity.
Well, thank you for this paper. It was really interesting.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So let's get into the heart of it. Before we do, can you please review for the audience what visual snow syndrome is and how is it diagnosed?
Yes, certainly. Well, the diagnostic criteria for visual snow syndrome actually appears in the ICHD, the International Classification of Headache Disorders, and it's listed there as a complication of migraine. So while it's associated with migraine, it's not actually thought to form part of the migraine spectrum. And the syndrome profile was actually developed to help provide focus for research into the symptom visual snow, which is its sort of central defining feature, by identifying a cluster of other visual symptoms that most often occur alongside visual snow. And visual snow itself is a persistent and dynamic perceptual phenomenon. It's sort of like a veil of flickering dots that fill the entire visual field. And I guess for those of us who can remember that far back, it's been described as something like looking at the static or of a badly tuned black and white television. And it's there 24/7, whether the eyes are open or closed. And as well as visual snow, the clinical features of the syndrome include at least two additional features from palynopsia, so after images or trailing images, enhanced entoptic phenomena, so excessive floaters, for example, blue field entoptic phenomena, spontaneous photopsia. And then there's photophobia, and lastly, nyctalopia, or impaired night vision. Of course, these are all self-reported or subjected experiences, so a diagnosis is entirely clinical, essentially ruling out anything else. So that involves taking a comprehensive history, characterising the symptomatology, and then examining the central nervous system, and of course, carefully examining the eyes themselves.
Now that we're all on the same page here, tell us about your objectives of the study and why you set out to perform the study.
All right. Well, our overarching objective was to help pinpoint what might be causing visual snow in the first place. So beyond a patient reporting symptoms that are consistent with the syndrome, as I've just described it, we've had, I guess, until really recently, very little evidence that there's anything wrong with them. And clinically, an ophthalmic or a neurological examination is typically normal. So normal visual acuity, normal OCT, no changes on clinical MRI, for example. And because it sort of seems like aura, it's been misdiagnosed historically as migraine. It's not migraine, although around half of all people with visual snow also have migraine, or it's been dismissed entirely as psychogenic. But there are so many patients that are clearly suffering, so not just from the visual symptoms I described, but often a host of other sensory changes like migraine, but also tinnitus, paresthesia, and even more, I guess, psychiatric symptoms like derealization and depersonalization. Although there's now a few small-scale studies in these patients that show us that there is something structurally or functionally different in the brain, like using more sophisticated imaging measures like PET or MRS, we're actually still a really long way away from working out what's driving visual snow in the first place, and even further away from finding a cure. There aren't any universally effective treatments for visual snow. So because the range of visual symptoms at least suggests a problem with visual processing, we firstly focused on seeing if we could actually measure these visual processing changes in people with visual snow. And because the oculomotor network essentially incorporates regions that process visual information as well as generate a measurable response, we used oculomotor tasks to help us do this.
Can you describe the different oculomotor tasks that you used?
Yeah, sure. We essentially presented participants with two fairly commonly used eye movement tasks. There were 64 patients, all with a confirmed diagnosis of visual snow syndrome. Half of them had migraine, half of them did not, and a group of age-matched controls. The first of these tasks was a Prosicard task, where we asked participants to simply look towards a suddenly appearing on-screen target. And the second was an anti-Sicard task, where we asked participants to look in the opposite direction to an on-screen target. More difficult than that sounds. But then we randomly interleave these two tasks, so getting participants to make a decision then about whether they look towards or away from the target, depending on the characteristics of a central cue. And that's essentially it.
Interesting. What were the major findings, and what does it tell us about the brains of these individuals suffering with visual snow syndrome?
So what we found was when we asked visual snow patients to look towards a target, they did so with significantly shorter latencies. They were much faster. And when we asked them to look away from a target, they failed more often. And this happened whether the Sicard types were presented as a block, so either all prosicards or all anti-Sicards, or whether they were randomly interleaved. What we didn't see were any differences on, I guess, more executive features of the interleaved task, like changes in their capacity to switch between tasks. And these are the sorts of things that the interleaved task measures, or unusual sequencing effects that you often see in patient groups. They were completely normal in this respect. And what this showed us is that poor inhibitory control, or making more anti-Sicard errors, wasn't likely to be a consequence of any higher order processes or changes to more frontal brain regions, which increased error is more usually associated with, but more likely a consequence of changes within lower level processing stages. And while these results don't actually tell us where the issue is, it lies somewhere within or between the thalamus and visual cortices, it sits nicely with a few of the emerging hypotheses in visual snow. And these include visual cortical hyperexcitability and thalamocortical dysrhythmia. But what's really important here is that we now have an objective measure of visual snow syndrome that we can firstly use in combination with in vivo assessments like MRI to explore these hypotheses further. And secondly, use as a quantifiable measure to assess the efficacy of any treatment that we might develop down the track, which is certainly a prerequisite to designing prospective clinical trials.
When I think about cortical hyperexcitability and cortical thalamic projections, I think about migraine. So how did the presence of migraine influence the ocular tasks?
So as I said, half of our patients also experience migraine. But when we compared the groups of patients with and without migraine, and the study was set up so that we could do this, we found no significant differences at all in any measure that we looked at. And while there's certainly some evidence that migraine might have, I guess, an independent effect on the metrics of a Sicard, the literature surrounding this is quite confounded by the use of prophylactic treatment, so the jury's still out somewhat in that.
Visual snow is very challenging to treat clinically. Based on what you know about the functional changes that occur, how can we best target patients that are suffering with this intractable condition?
Unfortunately, we don't really know enough yet about what's driving visual snow to say with any certainty how best to treat it. Of the medications that have been prescribed, I think it's only the Motrigine that has afforded any form of improvement, and only then in a really small minority of patients. There's certainly some anecdotal reports of a reduction of symptoms in a few patients when they view visual snow-like stimuli, so static that mimics the visual snow itself. And I guess these are sort of like acoustic CR modulation or coordinated reset modulation that's used in tinnitus, where a patient's own tinnitus frequency is effectively fed back into the system orally. And these are somewhat then consistent with both calming cortical hyperexcitability and resetting thalamocortical dysrhythmia. Having said that, the results are not especially compelling here. But certainly some of the comorbid symptoms can be addressed, migraine, for example. But actually, most patients cope pretty well just with reassurance. Many patients live with considerable anxiety about their symptoms. As you can imagine, anxiety and depression are really common. And it's this that can be addressed. Firstly, by providing acknowledgement in the first place that they're not mad, that their symptoms are real and not imagined, letting them know that while we can't treat visual snow just yet, there are people around the world working on it, and assuring them that there's no evidence that visual snow progresses or transitions into something life-threatening. So I guess for now, it's a more of a lifestyle management approach that's appropriate, that aims to reduce the anxiety and helps the patient manage or live with their symptoms. And that might mean pharmacological interventions like anxiolytics, but also things like mindfulness, meditation, or something more structured like cognitive behavioral therapy, for example.
You provided us a lot of great information and management tips on how to approach these patients. Any final comments about the importance of your study for general neurologists that may be seeing patients with visual snow?
So I think the real importance of our study lies in the fact that we can now show definitively that there are objective, measurable changes in the brains of people who report symptoms that might be consistent with a diagnosis of visual snow syndrome. And I'd like to stress that it's important to be open to the fact that a patient who reports visual snow isn't likely to be malingering, that the symptoms are real, that they do not have migraine, or at least not just migraine, and that management for now should focus on helping the patient come to terms with their condition and managing those symptoms that can be managed.
Joanne, this has been such a great talk. Thank you so much. Thank you for your work.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for listening to the Neurology Podcast. Be sure to check out the paper published in Neurology.
Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.